The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. No mai hoki mai ki a The Fold, e mihi nei ko Tangri Tokuingoa. My guest today will be familiar to people who've listened to The Fold intently, but also to very familiar to people who are explorers elsewhere in the Spinoff Podcast Network. It's Bernard Hickey, who is the host of When the Facts Change, another of our podcasts, a very, very good, heady dive into the political economy that comes out weekly. It's going to be returned in a couple of weeks, and I'm really excited about that. That's only one of the things that consumes Bernard's time and energy. And the other is the Kaka, which is a daily, often more than daily, newsletter that he started about 18 months ago. And I think it's one of the most interesting and sort of idiosyncratic products in New Zealand journalism. It's very much a thing which could only be made by him. There's a very long, dense, often digressive dives into the macro of, you know, three broad topics: housing, poverty, and climate change. And the reason I've had him back on, he recently wrote a manifesto, basically sitting down what he's learned over the first 18 months of the Kaka, and certainly the last 6 months since he turned on paid subscriptions, but also laying down a plan to kind of grow the base and to really refine and define what the product is about, which is very much about that focus and trying to open up. You know, he wants it to be free to all teachers and academics, to all journalists, and much more accessibly priced to people under 30. And there is actually like a good capitalist logic to that, as he makes reference to in this interview. But I think it's also this idea, this emerging idea, that there is a public interest in having public interest journalism available as widely as possible. So we talk about what he's learned over these past 18 months and about his sort of grand unifying theory of our political economy and what it's like basically developing that theory in real time and constantly putting it to a government, which when you hear Bernard asking questions of the Prime Minister or the Finance Minister, there's often a different kind of edge to the response, particularly to follow-up questions. And that, you know, on some level you feel like they're a bit hoo-ha about having to answer what they consider to be a variation on the same question, which, you know, he kind of characterises as a "but why?" And I sort of understand it from their level, in that Bernard is very much about policy and they ultimately have to be about policy but also about winning elections. But I think that having him developing these theories and explaining the way this whole joined up system of politics and policy and finance and ultimately how that impacts people's lives, having that developed over these forums and having the inner workings of bond markets and what things really cost and what the opportunity costs of that are, having that all put out in front of us, I think is a tremendously valuable public service. And I certainly really, really value the Kaka personally as a, you know, it can be quite dense and sometimes it can feel like it harps on a particular issue, but it also has a really kind of bracing scope to it. And it's definitely well worth a subscription if you're interested in that area. As is When the Facts Change, which is returning in May, as I said, and I really, really love as a product as well. And I think Bernard he's a natural blogger / newsletter writer. He's also a natural podcaster. Anyway, this is Bernard Hickey on The Fold. Enjoy. Kia ora, Bernard. Welcome back to The Fold.
Kia ora. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I was prompted to have you on again, and in some respects this is sort of similar to my conversation with Emily Wrights of a couple of weeks ago. You know, you're both Substack users and have both found it kind of economically transformative for the pair of you. And what I really loved that prompted me to get you back was that you wrote about, well, it was two pieces. There was a sort of a manifesto for what the kaka is, like that has kind of revealed itself over time. And then based on the response to that and some kind of clearly some deep thinking about what its function is for yourself and for New Zealand more broadly, you know, about where it could go and how it should be sort of understood and absorbed and so on. Do you want to just explain those revelations to me?
Yeah, I've stopped believing that I know much at all and that I like to just try stuff and see what happens. And particularly with a Substack where it's all about the paying subscribers and what it is they like and want and how often they tell their friends to subscribe, you really need to listen to what they're saying and also watch what they do. And I sort of knew that at the start, and I knew that I didn't have the completely full package, T's crossed, I's dotted at the start. So I had to sort of make it up as I went along. I knew I wanted to do some journalism in about the political economy. I wanted to make enough of a living out of it so that I could focus on it. And that, I thought that would take a couple of years of tweaking and trying stuff and seeing if there was an audience for a particular niche of things. Hadn't quite understood what the niche was or what the actual value was I was creating that people might pay some money for. I just sort of, you know, I'll write some stuff and see what happens. And I've been doing this for sort of 20 years of trying to make money from online news, and basically after a while began to think that I didn't know much at all and I should just jump in there and suck it and see. And so for the first year I was contractually blocked actually from stopping selling subscriptions. And in a way that was a blessing in disguise because it allowed me to experiment without too much pressure and to not feel that I was writing stuff that people didn't want, or it gave me a chance to just relax a bit. And then after a year, in September of 2021, we turned on the paywall and let's see what happens. And over time, I worked out that my pitch, the zone where I was doing things I wanted to do and subscribers were paying me the money that allowed me to do it, was for me to say, I'll do journalism about housing affordability, climate change in action, and child poverty. You pay me some money regularly, and I promise to give you that first. And I also promise to put out the deep dives that I do, the original reporting and analysis, to everyone. And you can share it and get the pleasure, I suppose, of feeling like the money you've paid has helped me do the work in the first place. So it took me a sort of a year and a half to zero in, you know, to circle around the drain until I found my hole in the floor, and that's where it is. And as it turned out, I thought it would take a couple of years to get to the point where I was making enough money to pay the bills. And I preface this quite seriously by saying I'm lucky in that I own a home and don't have to pay rent. It actually really makes a difference if you're not quite as old and experienced as me to have that leeway. And I thought it would take a couple of years. I got there within 6 months, and now I'm in a position to be a lot more open about making sure the stuff I do gets out there, and a bit more relaxed about feeling I've found my hole in the drain.
So I want to talk about those three elements and how you seized upon them, because it's in some ways like a quixotic place for a finance journalist or a journalist with extensive experience in markets and so on to end up. But before then, there were things in that second manifesto piece about, you know, the number of, you know, you were initially concentrating on making it financially sustainable for you, and that's happened very fast. And now it seems to be about what – You know, and this is in some respects what the spin-off members model is. You know, like people will pay, and part of what they pay to do is keep it free for everyone. You've now got enough for you to feel like you can survive financially based on your subscribers, and now you just want to get it to as many people as possible, which might paradoxically sort of end up also growing the subscriber base. So tell us about that and about the people that you're targeting and why you're targeting them in terms of you're wanting to expand that free audience for it.
Yeah, so I, a few months ago, asked people who were paying subscribers, and they're the only ones able to comment on the site, what is it they liked, they didn't like. I put a few suggestions in front of them to that I was going to, I was thinking of making it freely available for students and teachers, anyone with a .ac.nz email address or a .school.nz email address, and that I was also thinking of offering it to people under the age of 30 for only $30 a year, whereas the normal price is $190 a year. And I also suggested to them that I would open it up for the media, so for all journalists, so that they could see what I was reporting and saying, and it would inform their own journalism, maybe. Maybe they could just delete it from their email box. So I said to them, how about this? And some people said, yep, good idea. One or two said, hang on a minute, I'm paying for this. I want it for me. I don't want you to just give it away for free to others. I don't like the idea of these free riders. And secondly, luckily there was a small enough number that I decided to not take that view. And also the feedback I got from people was very much, we love what you do when you go deep dive. We're not so interested in high volume, just the facts man, you trying to recreate stuff for NZ Herald. We actually want you to step back a bit and take some time. And that was very useful for me because I could have done lots more of, you know, what I call fast twitch stuff. And I decided and agreed with them it was a good idea to step back a bit. So I tend to file once or twice a day, whereas in the glory days of blogging, you know, people were putting out 10 posts a day and all sorts of crazy stuff, which will burn you out real fast. And that was the history, actually, of the big bloggers, is that they started sort of 2009-10, and by 2015, 16, 17, they were all burnt out. And I didn't want to do that. And so that's where I've sort of settled after asking people what they wanted and then doing it. So now I put my stuff out. It's free for students, teachers. It's real cheap for people under the age of 30. And it's free for journalists because journalists never pay for anything, fair enough. And so that means that my journalism, hopefully, can have a wider impact. And the sort of, as you said, paradoxically, the dirty little secret is the bigger the audience of people, the more people are exposed to it, the more they think, gee, I quite like that. That's different. I want to help make sure that's here that next year as well as this year. I'll pay a little bit for it. And that's the ironic thing. The moment I said I wanted to open it up a bit more because I was at a point where I could afford to, the numbers of subscribers increased. So, hey, that's good. I wouldn't call it a plan or a strategy, more a sort of a stumbling into a direction that worked.
And that's kind of what's exciting about the space and where media is at right now, is that after a long period where it just felt like we were staring glumly at the ever decreasing prices of online advertising, now with various reader models around, there is growth and there is opportunity there. And I think, as you point out, what's interesting about that isn't just that there is a glimmers of hope for sustainable news media once again in the online space, not once again, probably for the first time, but also that community isn't just passively consuming your product, it's also giving you feedback that shapes the product itself. And in some respects, what you said about being given permission to not feel like you had to recreate what a sort of a fast twitch news homepage does must be quite liberating. The thing that I think is really fascinating for me is that before all this started, you know, I've been reading you for many years, and I always considered, you know, you've written about the political economy through that time. You've also written a lot about finance and markets and so on. And yet where you've settled on as a kind of a centre for the kaka is not in finance and markets, which are legendarily the most lucrative places to play from a journalism perspective. You know, you've got, you know, oftentimes your boss pays the bill, which is always nice. But you've kind of gone to the absolute opposite end of that, which is writing about the pernicious problems of housing, child poverty, and climate change. How does that work?
Yeah. Increasingly, over the last decade, really, my own thinking, focus, passion, really, has been to try to understand why our political economy doesn't work for some of these core things. And over those 10 years, they've gotten worse at not working on those core things, so housing, poverty, climate. And maybe it's my age, the fact I've got a couple of daughters who are in their late teenage years and 20s, and having to think about, you know, what's life going to be like for them in 30 or 40 years' time? And knowing that my time on the planet is limited, you know, mortality and that sort of thing will make you think, gee, I could make a lot of money, and I haven't been very successful at that, focusing on the commercial market, or I could do a lot of, well, not good, but I could at least try to bring some things to light that might make a difference in the long run. And every day I'm going to feel like, at the end of the day, like I've done something useful. I haven't just made someone else richer. And so that's what I've sort of accidentally, on purpose, stumbled into. And it actually turns out that for me, it's been a useful way to make a living. You know, I wouldn't in any way present this as some sort of model or solution or thing that everyone should do and that, you know, this is the way, because I'm extremely fortunate in a bunch of ways. I've been doing this for 30 years. Again, I don't have to rent. And increasingly, the costs of production, if you like, you know, laptops, I do podcasts every day. That stuff, that cost has dropped substantially, which allows me to do it. And also, Substack exists. The piece of the story I haven't mentioned yet, I think I might have mentioned last time, was that from 2012 to 2016, I actually built my own version of Substack and paid $50K to programmers to do a great job. But it was, you know, pretty useless compared to Substack in terms of its user experience, its robustness, its ability to adjust and to be, you know, a really useful place to be. And now they do all that for me. And thank goodness. And it allows you to scale faster and cheaper. And those things weren't there before. So I wouldn't suggest this as a model for everyone. I'm not suggesting every journalist quit their job and start a Substack. And also I'm aware that it's not a permanent state. So I happen to be one of the first ones in this sort of area doing that sort of journalism. But I know others will come along. And, you know, I charge $19 a month is the normal full price, $3 a month if you happen to be under the age of 30. If you're a Maserati driving 27-year-old paying $3, I'll find out eventually. But, because it's New Zealand. But I know it at some point when, you know, people have are paying for one or two Substacks and a subscription to a news organization and Netflix and something else, they'll go, you know, too many freaking subscriptions. I'll cut one or two of these. And can I really justify this one? Probably not. So for me, that's the sort of thing I'm a little bit wary of in the next few years is subscription fatigue and also the ability to create scale before that subscription fatigue sets in.
I mean, that's what, you know, speaking of Netflix, that's what they just found out very
rudely. If I get to 100 million before finding that, I'll be pretty happy.
Yeah, I think you might be doing okay, and your daughters. So the thing that you know, just to kind of return to that earlier point about housing, climate change, and poverty, like in some respects, like I say, as I've read you, you know, there's been this kind of long-running debate about in New Zealand about why don't we have productivity And so, and on some level, all of those things like sit behind it. You know, like a lot of our problems as a country and the things that we talk about at conferences about wanting to do and seem unable to do, they're actually because we have problems of housing, which impacts health and education. You know, we have problems around poverty, which impact you know, health and education and employment and health and so on. And it almost feels like from you studying the kind of business finance layer and seeing these stories kind of cyclically repeat, ultimately you go back to that place. And that's why, you know, in some respects, what makes you unique as a journalist, I think, is the fact that you understand the way the whole system is built. And that's the path that you've led there, right? A lot of people write about social issues, but they tend to write about the micro of it and not the macro of how it's made.
Yeah. So what I've learned is that to understand that bedrock of finance and debt and fiscal policy and monetary policy is really useful to look behind what the politicians are deciding and thinking about. Because every decision that Grant Robertson makes or every proposal from Christopher Luxon is informed by 20 or 30 years of what I call unspoken bedrock of assumptions that we won't even question or talk about because everyone knows them, or at least the people who will lend me money in government knows. And the thing is, they don't explain that to the rest of the public, but it's really important. So, for example, when Grant Robertson and Jacinda Ardern decided at Christmas or just before Christmas of 2020, in the middle of COVID, not to increase the benefit by $50 a week, even though Carmel Cipollone, the minister, had asked for it and MSD had asked for it. And the reason they said no is that Treasury said we needed to start tightening our belt because we needed to get our net debt down below 30% of GDP. Now, they didn't say that in their announcement or their speech. In fact, they didn't even make an announcement. We found out about it through an OAA 6 months later. But when I'm asking those questions of the ministers and trying to report on it, understanding that because I reported on the government bond markets in New Zealand in 1993, in Sydney in 1999, in London in 2003, I've spoken to the big swinging bond fund managers who used to be called the bond vigilantes, who now are just desperate to put their money into government bonds. So that helps me to have some confidence when I call bullshit on people and say, actually, no, you're making a decision here to sentence another generation to poverty because of some dogma that's come out of the bowels of the bond market over the last 30 years that you've never questioned, but actually I know enough about it to question it, and I know that things have changed. And so that's given me some experience and context, which is unusual just through a series of accidents of history, that my first paid job as a proper journalist was working for Reuters. And every day I had to ring the bond markets twice a day, and then I might do a rugby test and a cricket test and a whale stranding, and then I'd go back to the bond markets, which is, you know, lucky.
What's interesting to me about that is that those three pillars that you identify, you know, housing, climate change, poverty, they might well be three of the four things that this government would say are most important to it. And yet I certainly detect when I hear you asking questions of the Prime Minister or the Finance Minister that you might be the least popular member of the press gallery.
Yes. And then it's like Tova and Jessica and then Bernard. And I'm usually the last one to be called on. But that's fine. I do ask questions about these things which they aren't comfortable with because they know that I know. And they know that I come from a particular point of view which is the most immediate thing we can do. The rainy day that's right in our face every day is not enough housing, not enough climate change action, too many children living in poverty. And these are all things that could be addressed today with decisions that they make or don't make. And they're choosing not to make them often for reasons that I argue are not valid, even though Treasury and a whole bunch of other people and the dogma of 30 years of neoliberal, the debt markets decide our futures thinking is, in my view, wrong, having covered those same debt markets for 30 years and understanding them. So you're right, I am not a popular questioner, but I often find out things, and maybe they say things out loud that they prefer not to, or more importantly, they're saying things out loud that maybe even they didn't realise they know. So, for example, a couple of times I've challenged the Prime Minister on why she hasn't fully implemented the recommendations of the Welfare Expert Advisory Group. And she said, well, you know, we can't do everything in 4 years. Well, why not? Well, because we can't afford it. Why not? You could just afford $20 billion in cash subsidies to businesses for COVID, and you could afford $1 billion in subsidies for the air freight industry. So why not? Well, and eventually it comes down to Treasury told us we can't. And sometimes they answer the question and then they go, really? Yeah, I didn't know I believed that. Now, I'm speculating a bit here. They would never admit that in public. But behind the scenes, I've had discussions with people where they go, really? I assumed that was the way that it always was and never could change. And part of me would quite like to sort of be in on those meetings with the officials and grill the officials and in a way that puts them on the spot, because we often don't get a chance to do that from where we are.
I mean, and that's what's that kind of leads me to my next question, is that those set pieces, you know, whether it's the bridge run or various press conferences where you are directly interrogating the Prime Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister, there is a level of accessibility there, though you are asking it in front of the whole of the rest of the gallery as well. But, you know, I had Anna Fifield, the Dominion Post editor, on earlier this year, who talked about how frustrating it was that the questions that you would like to ask of officials, those officials are maddeningly inaccessible at times. And she wrote an extraordinary op-ed kind of calling attention to that. And, you know, given that this is, and this has been quoted back at the government many times, I'm sure they're heartily sick of hearing it, but there wasn't this idea that they would be the most transparent government in history. And there is a general thesis that that hasn't come to pass. Is that your experience? And, you know, how much does the sort of the inability to speak to people, and I've, you know, just to kind of pivot slightly, like I've spoken to people who have designed policy who would love the opportunity to actually go out and explain why it's been designed that way in public, but the comms people won't let them do it either. So in some respects, both parties actually would quite like to be able to talk to one another, but there's this thing sitting between them. And it does at times feel like our public, political and policy discourse is diminished by the fact that there is this kind of almost omerta around being able to even talk about it.
The phrase I think about most when I think about this conundrum or this machinery that gets plonked between officials and journalists and increasingly politicians is the one from Eisenhower, where he warned as he was leaving as president that the most important and dangerous force, and this is a former, you know, chief of the US Army, says the most important and dangerous force is the military-industrial complex, because in effect it starts driving policy rather than the other way around. Mm. And I think we're at that point now where the numbers of people in our PR industrial complex inside government.
And that's what Anna Fifield called it, the communications industrial complex.
And it now it drives the agenda more than others. So that puts an even greater responsibility on those people who have the privilege, and it is a privilege, to be in the press gallery or have a job where you are expected to ask politicians questions. It makes it even more important that you use those opportunities in the PM's press conferences, in the bridge runs and the caucus runs and any other chance you get to really put them on the spot and do the hard work, because ultimately, when you get that chance to ask them questions directly with a TV camera watching and seven booms, mic booms, there is nowhere for them to hide. And it's the last defence, really. And so we have to make sure we get that right. And my membership of the press gallery and my ability to ask questions and report the answers, for me, is one of the duties I have at the Kaka, is to talk to our subscribers. And most days I ask them, what do you want to know from the minister? Which curly questions should I ask? Which bits of information don't I have that would be useful when I get a chance to ask a minister a question?
When you think about that audience, and you know, you talk about, or you just then you spoke about, you know, effectively functioning as a conduit between your audience and those people. Who are your audience, and what you know? Because it obviously probably isn't like your classic NBR/business desk, you know, business and finance audience. It you know, like, and so I'm curious about who are those people who are willing to pay $190 a year for, you know, your quite strident analysis and reporting on these matters. And, you know, so, and how do they sort of help inform the thesis that you're often presenting to government?
Yeah, I mean, there is a danger that you're essentially creating a fan club around you and you never get challenged at all. And that's one of the reasons why I'm keen to open it up as much as possible. I wouldn't call my subscribers that, and because I do get called out. You know, people say, really? Are you sure about that? What facts are you using? And then I'll go through, and if necessary, I'll document the facts I have, although I try when I write my articles and do my podcasts to, you know, source original source documents. But often I will get asked questions that go, actually, I hadn't really thought about it that way, or I need to ask that exact question of someone because I don't know the answer to that yet. So that's very useful. If I was to do a demographic analysis of it, which I can't really, other than to say anyone who's paying me money is probably has some assets of some sort, is probably a homeowner, probably is a bit older, I suspect that. Although increasingly I can see the demographics edging lower and also being a bit wider. So I'd probably start off with the same, you know, grumpy old men like me. But it has, as the numbers have grown over time, become wider. And also people, what surprised me a little bit is that people from other parts of the political spectrum have subscribed, particularly the ones who are self-aware enough to know that they need to subscribe to things from people who aren't their point of view, so to speak. So, for example, I know that I subscribe to Wall Street Journal, The Australian, NBR, The Telegraph, and the FT, although I think the FT is closer to the centre and even the left, and you might be surprised. But those other ones, you could argue centre-rightish, a couple of them, Rupert Murdoch. And I subscribe to them for the real reason I want to be surprised and challenged by people who've coming at it from a different point of view. So there's that group, which I appreciate, and it actually informs the debate. And the other thing is to ensure through this offering up free subscriptions to students, you know, we're talking 11-year-old economics students and 35-year-old PhD students, as well as all the teachers, and also this $30 per year deal for under 30s, is trying, my attempt to try and broaden it out beyond what you could, you know, say was the, you know, everyone agrees with everyone else, lovely little bubble. And that's one of the drawbacks of only allowing paying subscribers to comment, that you don't get the anonymous stuff. But by the flip side, you also don't get the nasty stuff. And for me, that's one of the revelations. I was particularly nervous about allowing comments. You and I have both been through that experience of it's fantastic to start with and then the trolls come and it's horrible. And in the end, you want to protect your staff and your own health by turning it off, as well as a lot of work. But in my case, that's been one of the really pleasant surprises, is by limiting the comment function to only paying subscribers, there is an investment in creating and sustaining a sane, nice place to be. So I've yet to have to cancel anyone. And maybe as it gets bigger and I offer it to more people for free, maybe that'll be an issue. But that for me has been one of the real, really pleasant surprises, is how constructive and human the commenters have been.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Well, one thing which is quite interesting to me is like to return to that sort of bond vigilante kind of foundation sort of what you're doing, which is, you know, like if I was to make a grossly reductive characterization of what you've said consistently, is that we can afford to do a lot more than we try and do. And, you know, you've often made these statements about the volume of housing we could build for 200 billion, you know, or you know,
yeah, half a million houses, 250 billion.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of thing. Is there any sense that was a thesis that fit that sort of seemingly permanent low inflationary environment? And that, I don't know if you saw, I know that you're also a reader of another great newsletter, Full Stack Economics, which basically talked about how the thesis generally was that the facts have changed, and we'll talk about that in a second, but that fundamentally, by having more expensive money, having a tightly constrained labour market and the supply chain issues, that we now can't do, you know, like a massive infrastructure building project because there just isn't the capacity in the economy. And if we'll look, you know, if you think about the amount of inflation we have right now, that could get very, very scary very quickly. Is there any sense that, you know, because that was a long-running thesis and it was extremely compelling, and it ran for years. Like it was a clear decade whereby there seemed to be that capacity. And, you know, there's this part of me that when I was reading Full Stack this morning, I was like, have we squandered that opportunity? Because we still have all those problems, as you suggested.
No, it's absolutely a fair challenge. You know, the facts have changed. We now have higher inflation and higher interest rates. Doesn't that wipe out your thesis? It's a fair challenge. Firstly, if it does wipe out the thesis, yes, what a wasted opportunity. But actually, I don't think it does. And for example, we've just had 6.9% unemployment, but the government can still borrow money at 3%. So in effect,
inflation.
Yeah. Effectively.
There's an arbitrage.
Yeah, play. Yeah. Essentially, it's not just free money. It's real interest rate is a negative interest rate. So you could argue that even makes it even more compelling to do it with debt in one form or another. But also part of the thesis, aside from the debt issue, is the issue of public investment. And one of the problems we've had in the last 30 years, and it's the neoliberal revolution of the last 30 years, globalization, lowering tax rates, moving to markets, all of that. The assumption was that public investment was always going to be bad and it never makes sense. When actually what this thesis about debt does is forces you to think about the returns on investment from public investment, if you take into account the wider economic, public health, well-being effects. And still, we're not doing enough of that. So I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But A, I still think the thesis is intact. But B, even if it's challenged, it's now even more important to get right the investment analysis on public investment. And it also is a reminder that we need to do the work now when it's supposedly free money. I mean, hell, a negative real interest rate of 4%. That's what the government has at the moment. It could issue debt and effectively, when it repays the money, repay a lot less in real terms. And so, I'm still in team transitory on inflation. It's just a slightly longer transition.
And you know, one thing I sort of wonder, because you have this sort of this big joined up thesis and that you sort of spill out over over podcasts and newsletters and are kind of constantly developing with the government. And there can be at times a real hostility to that or almost like a sense of, oh, it's Bernard again with his theory. Does it get lonely? Like, because you're also like, you've gone from being part of these big newsrooms and part of teams to now essentially the kākau is you. I'm sure, you know, yeah. Lynn takes the odd photograph, but and I'm sure is a big support. But, you know.
Yeah. No, that's one of the drawbacks. One of the things I enjoyed very much about being at interest.co and also newsroom is that I felt like I was building a team, that I was part of a team, that I was able to, in a way, leverage some of the experience and interests that I had into other areas. I could literally ask reporters to go and ask those questions because I haven't got time to do it, and they'd come back with fantastic answers, and it would be a bigger product than just me. And if I was being a really aggressive business builder, capitalist, and I am a capitalist, I would be doing that and, you know, asking for money from investors and, you know, and occasionally people have suggested that I should have a crack at that. But the guts of the problem for me is I've failed, actually, a couple of times to do this in any way that creates large amounts of shareholder value. I also don't have an awful lot of confidence that I could investor money in a way that would guarantee them returns, frankly, that are better than a rental property.
Okay.
yeah, exactly. And also, I'm 55. I'm old and tired. So it is me, and it'll probably stay me because I don't have the risk appetite or the energy to make it bigger than me. However, I can work with a lot of other journalists in the press gallery, and I spend a lot of time talking to TV and radio producers off air going, this is a good question, and have you seen this? And let me send you this link to this. And they go, gee, that's fantastic, Ben. I'm sorry we can't have you on the show tomorrow morning, but that's brilliant. And then I see the questions that echo through in the actual interview that's on air. And I feel like I'm contributing that way as well. And as a member of the press gallery, you feel on a bound to be collegial to other people. And I've spent the last 10, 15 years talking, just shooting the breeze with a bunch of other journalists who are sort of interested in economics and the political economy. They may have become more interested in the political economy. So, you know, people like Thomas Coughlin and Henry Cook and Janae Tipshraney and a whole bunch of people. They come to me with questions all the time. Now, I don't always have the answers and they may have a different view, but I know that a lot of that stuff is filtering out in lots of different ways. And although it doesn't crystallize into shareholder value for me, unfortunately, it feels fun actually I enjoy talking to other journalists. And one of the offsetting things, I mean, I could be completely on my own and stuck in my own office, and that's dangerous too. You end up talking to your typewriter. And there's some people who do that occasionally. But actually being in the press gallery means you sort of have the benefits of a newsroom without having the salary that you have to pay every month. And I enjoy that. I'm really keen to retain that privilege.
Lastly, we've talked a lot about the kākau, and one of the things that we haven't touched on is the fact that part of what has made it sustainable for you, or part one of the benefits of it, is that you've been able to cut down on the sort of some of the other gig economy type stuff that you were doing prior to that to kind of earn a living. But the one thing that you have kept is another podcast from the Spinoff Podcast Network, which is When the Facts Change, which will be returning in a few weeks' time. Do you want to, if it's not too indulgent for both of us?
But no, I'm incredibly proud and love that I've been involved in creating this thing with the spin-off When the Facts Change. I so love all the help I've gotten from producers, and I've learned so much, and I'm really pleased that I can continue. This is my one other gig apart from the Kaka, because as I mentioned in my sort of manifesto-y thing from a week or two ago, it meshes completely with my public interest journalism focus of the Kaka, and that I do lots of interviews and storytelling, if you like, through the podcast on climate change, housing, and poverty. In what essentially is, in theory, a podcast about the political economy, but just about every story has an economic or a political flavour, but increasingly every story ends up at housing affordability, climate change, and poverty. So, for example, every story that I could see around the world has something to do with those three issues. And in fact, the solutions to those three issues are, in effect, the ones that could solve a lot of our other problems. If we could get rid of our fossil fuel dependence, we might not have wars in Ukraine or the Middle East. If we could solve a lot of our child poverty issues, we might not have the political grief that we have in so many places at the moment. And if we could solve our housing affordability issues, that's so much political grief and well-being issues solved right there. So if I can get that stuff out to the public, it's another fantastic way in which I can understand and tell those stories and have it made public. That's fantastic. I'm very grateful to the spin-off and to its sponsors, and in the current case, KiwiBank, for allowing me to do that. It's been, for me, you know, one of the great pleasures of the last couple of years is learning that, but also being able to, again, leverage off that work I do with the Kaka and make it sustainable.
Well, if you're listening and don't subscribe, I strongly urge you to go and get, at the very least, the free sub to the Kaka and find When the Facts Change on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bernard, thank you so much for coming up.
Cheers, Duncan.
The Fold is brought to you by the Spinoff Podcast Network, together with Vodafone. It was hosted by Duncan Grieve, produced by T.I. Hebb Butler, with production management by Rachel LaRue and series production by Jane Yee. To find out how Vodafone can help you reach your personal and business potential, visit vodafone.co.nz.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oOh!media for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.